This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad to have you tuned in. Thanks for joining us. At Seattle University, students are back in class after protests last spring. Some students at SU's Humanities College accuse the school of marginalizing them, tokenizing them with a mostly white faculty and its curriculum focus on Western civilization. Today, we want to know, what have student organizers accomplished, not just at Seattle U, but in general, nationwide? And are those accomplishments and those demands at odds with the free exchange of ideas we want on our campuses? And our guest is Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history and education at New York University and author of the book Campus Politics. Jonathan, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think student activists are right if they say America's liberal arts colleges are oppressive?
Well, look, it depends what you mean by the term, of course, and I know that's what all professors say, right? Mm. But I can well understand why some students of color might look at certain curricula that focus only on white people and feel that that oppresses them. The question is what to do about that.
Let's just start there. What should we do about it?
Well, look, I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, up until the 1960s, almost all education in this country, especially education in the humanities, focused on white people, mainly white men, because it wasn't thought that other people had much of a history or culture to explore. That day has departed, thankfully. And I do think it's fair to say that at most of our institutions, there's been enormous diversification of the curriculum, just like there has been of the student body and of the faculty. Perhaps not as much as there should have been, but I think that if you look at recent history, I think it's fair to say that there's been enormous, enormous movement towards diversity in all of those realms.
So this is a campus-by-campus issue, but in general, do you think that students ought to be satisfied with the gains they have, or make our universities, our colleges, more diverse in curriculum than they are, less focused on Western civilization?
Well, look, let me be clear. I myself, I'm a former student activist and student journalist. I don't think anybody should be satisfied with anything. And I absolutely applaud students for expressing their dissatisfaction. I think that's actually what they are supposed to do. The problem becomes when they silence people who do not agree with them. Everybody has a right to speak their mind about the curriculum and the composition of the faculty and everything else. What they don't have a right to do is insist that their own view be normative and that other views be silenced.
Do students really have the power to silence others? I mean, I know there's an occasional shouting down, but really, is it fair to say students are silencing ideas?
It's not. And I should be a little more careful in my use of that term. I don't think people have been silenced, but I do think that there have been very profoundly disturbing attacks on free speech on our campus. For example, the stealing of newspapers. So a student organization decides that a campus publication has something offensive or racist in it and steals the entire print run. It may not be fair to call that a silencing, because surely the person who wrote whatever was stolen still has speech rights. They haven't been silenced, but it absolutely is an attack on free speech, and anybody who cares about the exchange of ideas on our campuses or outside of them should be deeply troubled by that.
Some students, as you know, have used the language of psychological health, trauma, illness. Is there anything wrong with that?
Yes, I think there's something profoundly wrong with it. Look, I have no doubt that there are certain images and certain ideas that can cause upset and that can cause distress for people who hear them. But that's a poor idiom. It's the wrong idiom for dialogue, for political expression, precisely because it can't really be contested. Look, if you feel mentally harmed or traumatized by something I've said, I can't really have a discussion with you. Indeed, should I question your experience of trauma, you might legitimately argue that I'm, quote, re-traumatizing you. The language of psychology does not overlap well with political discussion. Indeed, my fear is it often constrains and constricts it.
Is it that we can't have a discussion if you claim to be psychologically harmed? Or could it be that, for example, the president of Seattle University answered protesters by saying, I cannot pretend, this is a quote, cannot pretend to know how deep your pain goes, the amount of harm it has caused, or the extent of our own shortcomings. And then the university goes on to form this task force. They haven't thrown their curriculum all up in the air. But as you say, yeah, I can't know your psychological trauma, but isn't that just the reality? I can't know. And I acknowledge that, and we move on together.
Right. But the question is, how do we move on? And does something that traumatizes you, or that you claim traumatizes you, does that give you some sort of right, to use that term, to be insulated from that idea or that term? I don't think it does. And I'd go even further. I think when we educate people to feel traumatized, to feel victimized, we make exchange even more difficult. So to take a really good example, at Harvard about a year ago, somebody vandalized the law school and put black tape over the faces of the portraits of the faculty of color. And Randall Kennedy, who teaches at the law school and is himself African-American, he wrote a really good piece after that, and he pointed out that there were huge protests by students of color and others claiming that this action was deeply traumatizing and harmful to them. And Kennedy made a couple basic points. First of all, he said, how do you know the intent of the vandal? I mean, it's possible the vandal was trying to do some sort of political theater or statement about the muzzling of black voices. So we don't know that there was a racist intent here, although that's what everybody believed. And secondly, even if there was, even if we could find that out and discern that, how is it helpful to anybody to teach them that the way to conduct a discussion is to underscore the mental trauma that you've experienced? You know, Kennedy pointed out he wasn't traumatized by that, even though his portrait was one of the ones that was defaced. And he questioned whether anybody should feel traumatized, and most of all, whether their subjective experience of trauma should be any sort of barometer of the kind of discussion that takes place after that.
This is a good time to, by the way, we're talking with Jonathan Zimmerman, author of the new book, Campus Politics. It's a good time to bring in a student. And we have on the line with us a Seattle University graduate, Jenna Hyder. Hi, Jenna.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. I know you joined the sit-in last spring. You were in meetings with the administration. Now, our guest isn't in Seattle and doesn't know the particulars of Seattle University. But I want you to respond to some of the things you've heard. He just said that that students are perhaps being educated to feel traumatized. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think that it's an incredibly interesting statement to make, that it is more important for academics to really take the time to parse and redefine trauma rather than just, you know, taking the word of the students who say they've experienced it. Like, it's almost as if you don't trust us to accurately represent our own experiences, and I have a problem with that, quite frankly.
Well, you know, Jenna, first of all, thanks a lot for your comments. I'm not questioning your experience of trauma. You know, as in the quote that the host just gave, what you experience is what you experienced. I can't speak to its depth. I can't speak to its profundity. But to continue the metaphor of speak, I can say that I don't think your trauma, however you're experiencing it, should be relevant in the question of whether you and I can speak about the issues of the day. That's not questioning what you feel.
If a linchpin of your argument is that we will always have equal footing in any conversation about academia, quite frankly, that's not true. And when you try to tell me that the only thing getting in the way of us having a free exchange of ideas is my attitude, that doesn't work. That ignores generations of systemic racism and sexism in higher education.
But Jenna, how will anybody, you or me, challenge that history and challenge those structures if our speech is restricted? I would never contest the presence of racism in our society, especially at this moment in our history. What I would contest is the possibility of challenging racism or any of our other problems if we're constricting our exchange of ideas. That's not a good formula for this challenge.
Can I ask both of you, Jonathan, what's an example of how protests impede the exchange of ideas? Not just anger people, you know, not just result in a debate over who meant what, but But that, isn't that the argument? In part, we are shutting down, silencing the exchange of ideas. What's an example?
Well, I mean, doesn't the stealing of newspapers or the rejection of campus speakers do that? I mean, again, as per our earlier points, I don't think silencing is the right metaphor, because we do have a First Amendment in this country, and people are extraordinarily free to speak their minds. But our campuses should be places where anybody can say anything. You don't have to agree with them. You're free to contest them, but you have to be free to contest them. They have to be free to say what they're saying, and we won't challenge any inequality or any injustice in our society if we constrict our speech. All of the great warriors against injustice, Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, William Lloyd Garrison, Eugene Debs, have also been warriors for free speech, because they understood that without that tradition, they can't challenge any injustice.
Jenna, what do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, the First Amendment only protects individuals from government reaction to free speech. It absolutely does not protect those expressing oppressive or racist ideas from the reaction of those who those statements victimize. Second, I don't know exactly what the relevance to stealing college newspapers has to the action at Seattle University, which is what I was invited to speak on, because that didn't happen with us. So I'm not really sure what the point of that is.
But yeah, you don't have to speak to stealing newspapers. Let's end with your discussion. I realize Jonathan Zimmerman is not at Seattle U. I'll ask you finally, Jenna, what do you feel was accomplished, and do you have any regrets about student protests in Seattle?
What we accomplished was that Jody Kelly, who for years oversaw a racist and oppressive curriculum and culture at Matteo Ricci, did take retirement. She has been replaced with an interim dean. There is currently a task force in place that is reviewing the culture and curriculum of the college. They are reviewing testimony that has been collected for years from both students and faculty, alleging various abuses, both from Jody Kelly on the personal level and from Seattle University on the systemic level. Our voices are finally being heard, not fully, and it's taking a lot of time, but we are finally being listened to. Also, it's a little bit of an oversimplification to suggest that we just immediately jumped to protest. We didn't. We tried all the proper channels first. Students have been taking their claims through the grievance process for years. Nothing has happened. I have absolutely no regrets about our actions. I think that we engaged in very successful decentralized leadership. We accomplished the goals that we set out at the beginning of the organization. My only real regret is that we are still having conversations with white people and people in positions of institutional authority, where they suggest that we are still complaining about issues on an individual level and suggesting that our trauma does not deserve to be rectified on our terms.
Seattle University graduate Jenna Hyder, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we may talk to Jenna again. We've talked to Seattle U students before and look forward to doing that again. I'll give you the final word to our guest, Jonathan Zimmerman. Finally.
Well, let me be clear. First of all, I 100% endorse students at Seattle University or any university in protesting curricula or behavior that they find offensive or prejudicial or racist or just uneducational. 100%. But the question is, on what basis? I would contest the idea that a challenge on the basis of experienced trauma is on its face a legitimate challenge, not because the trauma isn't experienced or real, but because it is subjective. If the curriculum at Seattle University or the faculty at Seattle University are racist, you got to do better than I feel traumatized. Okay? You've got to show in chapter and verse precisely where the bigotry exists, precisely how it is operated in the classroom and elsewhere, and make an argument that's beyond your subjective experience of trauma.
Jonathan?
Look, I wasn't there.
Yes.
Yeah, please.
Yes. We hope to talk to you again. That's the time we have for it today. And we'll watch Seattle U, as Jenna said, they formed a task force. We'll watch them. And will you talk with us again?
I'd be delighted to.
Jonathan Zimmerman, a professor of history and education, now at University of Pennsylvania. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the book is Campus Politics. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. It was fun.
It's KUOW's The Record. While Seattle's known for being liberal, Republicans like it here too. Yes, some of them cheered in Seattle for Donald Trump in the debate this week. Thousands voted for Republican candidates in the last primary, and one block in particular stands out as the most Republican block in Seattle. KUOW's David Hyde asked data reporter Abe Epton to take a closer look.
The most Republican block in Seattle is 116 North Fairview in South Lake Union.
Most Republican block. What do you mean by most Republican block?
Where the most Republicans voted in the presidential primary.
So raw numbers of voters.
Exactly.
What's there?
There's an enormous upscale retirement building called Mirabella on that block.
I'm here at Mirabella in South Lake Union in Seattle, and there's nothing here that would immediately make you think this was a particularly Republican block. There's no people wearing Donald Trump hats or Hillary for prison in 2016 t-shirts. I guess there's a Mercedes parked in the driveway, but I mean, that could be anybody. But I'm about to go inside and meet a couple of folks who are Republicans, the Capilottos.
We are at a very important place in our history in this country.
As Republicans who live on the most Republican block in deep blue Seattle, what do they think of the presidential candidates this year?
I'm rather disappointed in them.
Bob Capilotto worked for years in PR here in Washington State, mostly for political campaigns. His most memorable was an anti-union initiative that passed back in the 1960s. So why is he so disappointed with Donald Trump?
I'm offended sometimes by the way he talks to people. I don't like the way he puts people down, but I will say one thing for him. He speaks in American. He doesn't speak politically, and that's refreshing to a lot of people. That's where we are.
So who are the Capilottos going to vote for this year?
Right now, I would say that we would lean toward voting for Trump.
Dodi Capilotto agrees.
I think Trump is a very smart man. And if he should win, I feel confident that he would have very intelligent and knowledgeable people on his staff and in his cabinet. And I just wish he'd stop putting his foot in his mouth.
And what about Hillary Clinton?
I'm not as fond of Hillary. I'm not fond of either one, actually.
So that's two lukewarm votes for Donald Trump. But in Washington state races in the primary, the Capilottos actually voted for more Democrats than Republicans.
Why did we vote for them? Well, they were the most qualified, and that's what we need in the state.
So what's it like for them living in Mirabella, the most Republican block in true blue Seattle?
I'd say most of them would probably be Democrats.
Wait, what? This block has mostly Democrats? But our data reporter, Abe Epton, told me this is the most Republican block in Seattle.
Well, it's way more Republican than Seattle. It's only two-thirds Democrats. As a whole, Seattle had 15 times more Democrats than Republicans voting in the primary.
Okay, so in a nation increasingly divided between red and blue states, and in a city where residents are often accused of living in some sort of liberal bubble, people in both major parties live together here at Mirabella. And how do they get along?
We have interesting discussions here. It's very civilized and so far.
Okay, that's the Republican view. What's it like for Democrats living here? How do they feel about living in a block that has more Republican voters than any block in Seattle?
Well, I just found that out. And since I found that out, I thought, well, you know, it's interesting. If I did think about it, I guess many people here would be Republican.
Marty Kuschmarek is a registered Democrat. And like most Democrats in Seattle, he's not a fan of Donald Trump.
I think he is just a personal aggrandizer. I actually don't think he has any real principles except how to make a name for himself and how to make money.
Pat Kuschmarek agrees.
I think that he cares about nobody on earth except Donald Trump. I think that he has no trouble, I'll just say, telling falsehoods or at least exaggerating the truth. And that he is erratic and just an unfit person to be president of anything, never mind the United States of America.
But Hillary Clinton,
she has a good head on her shoulders. She certainly has had more experience than almost any other person who's ever run for this office. You know, having her stint as First Lady, then being in the Senate, then being Secretary of State. I know that she has downsides, but don't we all?
So when it comes to politics, the Kushmeriks are pretty outspoken. But how well does everyone living here, all of these Republicans and all of these Democrats, get along at Mirabella? Do they ever talk about politics?
Only when you're with people that you are pretty sure share your opinion. And then we talk a lot.
But what about when you don't have politics in common?
We just avoid those kind of discussions. Everybody has to wake up on November 9th, and you still have to be friends and neighbors.
On the most Republican block in Seattle that also has a lot of Democrats, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
This is KUOW's The Record.
Transgender is when, for example, your kid is born and you think it's a boy, but it feels like a girl.
That's from a podcast about a single mom raising her trans daughter here in the Seattle area. It's called How to Be a Girl. KUOW's teamed up with that mom, Marlo Mack, to bring you that podcast. Now, Marlo Mack is a pseudonym so that she can help protect her daughter's privacy. Hi, Marlo.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Some of what we hear in this podcast is just kid stuff, like this.
My tickle monster.
Tickle monster.
The tickle monster. Which came first, Marlo, the recordings that you made or the podcast?
I had actually started recording my child pretty much from the beginning, but I wasn't a radio producer. I was just a parent, so I was doing it for fun and for posterity. And then around 3 years old, my child, at the time my son, I thought, started saying some very surprising things.
What was one of those things that you remember?
I'm a girl.
For example?
Not real subtle, yeah. Coming from your son, or the person you think is your son.
Yeah. And then your child said something pretty startling about how she formed?
Yeah. We're in the living room and she's looking up at me saying, he at the time says, Mama, something went wrong when I was in your tummy that made me come out as a boy instead of a girl. And please put me back so I can come out the right way as a girl.
What went through your mind?
Oh my God, how am I going to make this okay? I have to fix it. I'm the mom. I'm in charge. I have to make this okay. And what I said to her was, it's okay. You can be a girl. You can be a girl. You can be a girl. And I'm saying this to my child thinking, how can I follow through on that promise? Because I'd never met a transgender person. I barely understood what it was. But that somehow I had to, you know, create some magic so that she could be a girl.
How did you go about making that magic?
Well, I was pretty slow with my magic. I'm not sure how magical it was. I really pushed back on that. You know, I dragged my heels on delivering on that promise, asking all the same questions that I think anyone listening to me would ask. You know, how could a 3-year-old know this about themselves? You know, it's clearly, it must be a phase, right? What did you do wrong? What kind of crazy mom are you that you created a child who would come up with this? Every possible, you know, what did I eat that I shouldn't have when I was pregnant? You know, every possible self-doubt and doubting my child that you could come up with. And I pushed back for almost a year saying, you know, you say you're a girl, but, you know, I think what I tried to do was expand the definition of boy. So I said, well, you can be any kind of boy you want to be. You know, you can be the pinkest boy on the planet. You can have every princess doll. I drew the line at, you know, buying dresses. You know, I kind of pushed back there, but I tried to be, you know, the best progressive Seattle liberal parent you could possibly be, and say, you know, we're just going to do gender differently in our house.
In the first episode of How to Be a Girl, which you produced before KUOW teamed up with you, we can hear you trying to figure it all out.
Why do you like princesses so much?
I just kind of do.
Do you think it's okay for boys to like princesses?
But I'm a girl.
You keep trying. She keeps trying, too, to tell you.
Yeah, I know. I sound pretty thick there.
Pretty human? Pretty not knowing what to do in every moment?
Right. Yeah.
How did you get to where you are now?
I think what happened for me was that I saw my child slipping away from me. The more that I didn't acknowledge her, the more that I just pretended this wasn't going on, the more she was kind of, he at the time, started to ignore me, slip away. When my child would hear me use a male pronoun, you know, in the third person talking to someone else, or if my child would hear her boy name, there would just be this shrinking, this kind of disappearing. And, you know, she was giving up on her mother. And that's when I said, I have to step up. I have to be there for this kid. And so the advice I got was, I got some amazing advice from a therapist, actually, who specializes in working with transgender kids. And I said, you know, the thing I'm most terrified of is, what if I say, or, and this is what I think almost every parent I know with a transgender child goes through, is, what if I say that thing? What if I let them go there and then I'm pushing them there? Or what if I say this thing and then they're stuck in the wrong gender forever? You know, well, can you imagine if someone said that about their gay child? You know, what if I tell them it's okay to be gay and then I make them gay? No one would ever say that. And so the advice I got from this therapist was, you know, there's nothing that you can do or say that will make your child transgender or not transgender. And it was like the clouds parting. It was a get out of jail free card. It was, I don't control this. And thank God this child is, I mean, I think it's something every parent has to come to at some point, is your child is who they are, and how we don't get to dictate how they're going to turn out on so many things. And this was a big one, but I got to let it go. And so I another moment I'll never forget, I went home and I sat her down on the couch in the same living room where we'd had our first moment, and I said, do you still feel like a girl? And she said, no, I still am a girl. And I said, okay, so now you're going to be a girl, and we're going to do that now. And I hear you. And from that moment on, she's been my daughter.
That's Marlo Mack, the single parent of a transgender daughter. KUOW's teamed up with Marlo to collaborate on her podcast, How to Be a Girl. The first episode of the season is available today wherever you get your podcasts. You can hear an excerpt of that podcast tomorrow on The Record. And there's so much more to talk about here, including how scary it is for Marlo to be coming out with this podcast, even anonymously, and how she balances her fears for her daughter's safety with her hopes for a world that's more understanding. You can read about Marlo's struggles with all of that, too. We're tweeting out a link to her blog now. So follow us at KUOW. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Jessica Bennett had had enough insults and microaggressions from her male colleagues, so she and some of her female friends teamed up and formed a club, the Feminist Fight Club, to compare notes and figure out how to react to sexist acts. And Bennett's got a new book out with the same name, The Feminist Fight Club, which she says is a manual for surviving a sexist workplace, Jessica? Do I have that right?
That is right. A battle manual.
A battle manual. Jessica's from, you were born and raised in Seattle.
I was.
Now in New York. You write for the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the Feminist Fight Club you started with your friends at work. Why'd you do that?
Yeah. So, you know, I was born and raised here. Progressive parents called themselves feminists, told I could accomplish whatever I set my mind to. And I did. And then I entered my first job at Newsweek magazine in New York. And I started running up against these barriers. I would pitch an idea and it would get rejected, but it would appear on the pages of the magazine under a male byline. I found out after a few years that a man, a friend of mine who was at the same level as me, was making about $10,000 more. And all of these things began to add up. So I started talking with female colleagues, with other friends in different industries, and we decided we wanted to form a club to talk about some of these issues.
A feminist fight. What is the first rule of Feminist Fight Club?
Well, so initially the rule of the Feminist Fight Club, this is where the title came from, was that we didn't talk about it outside the group. And that was very real at the time. There were women involved in the group who did feel like if it got out in their respective workplaces that they were in what was essentially a feminist consciousness raising group, they would be penalized. But here we are 10 years later, and now the rule, the first rule of the Feminist Fight Club, is you must talk about the Feminist Fight Club.
Mm. You talked about sexism. You helped each other come up with ideas. And how did your male coworkers react?
Well, it was interesting because I think that a lot of the male coworkers were very supportive and really believed in this stuff as well. You know, we're millennials, we're young, we believe in equality. Most of our male friends believe in equality too. And a lot of the sexism we were facing was not the overt kind of sexism of my mother's generation. You know, want ads were not segregated by gender. We were not told, like the women of Newsweek in a previous era were told, that they were not allowed to be writers. To the contrary, we were told we could accomplish everything. And the men wanted to support us. But I think that the thing with some of the sexism we face today is that it's subtle. It's unconscious. And women exhibit it and men exhibit it. And sometimes we don't even realize it.
What are you hoping to teach? What do you want women to do in the workplace? What's your advice?
So there's so much talk about gender issues now. You know, I've done some work with Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In, and I think that Lean In ushered this new age where we talk about a lot of the gender bias that exists. You know, clearly with the election, we're talking about this stuff. But so much of the research out there and so much of the conversation and the media focuses on the problems. And I know that for myself, starting out, I was a 20-something in a workplace. I knew that there were a lot of structural issues I wanted to fight for. Equal pay, paid maternity and paternity leave, all of these structural things. But, you know, I'm like 24 and kind of powerless. And like, what am I supposed to do in the moment when I'm getting interrupted every time I speak or having my ideas attributed to a male colleague? So what I would like to do in this book is provide very practical, in the moment tactics that women can employ to deal with some of the things that they face.
You use the word tactics. I think you said battle manual. Is the fight club war survival metaphor more helpful than hurtful?
I think so. I think a lot of what we talk about these days are sort of these soft ways of overcoming these issues. You know, we don't even talk about feminism. We talk about empowerment. And I want to be a little bit aggressive. I think we can be a little bit aggressive, and we need to. I also want to be humorous. I think that humor has a way of bringing people in to talk about complicated issues that they may not normally feel comfortable discussing. And so you'll notice the front cover of the book says this book is 21% more expensive for men.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really. That would be illegal. But it's calling attention to the wage gap. Women make 21% less on average. So I think that sometimes humor has a way of opening these issues up. And I think that, you know, fighting and battling and considering this a fight is not necessarily a bad thing.
So walk me through some of your survival battle manifesto lingo. We have manterrupter. What's a manterrupter?
Well, if anyone...
I mean, I think I know what it is, but go ahead.
If you watched the debate the other night...
Do you want me to just explain it?
Yeah, can you explain it to me?
Sorry. Manterrupter. Go on.
So Donald Trump is a manterrupter. In the debate that we all watched, he interrupted Hillary Clinton something like 51 times. She interrupted him once. Now, this is kind of a funny term to call this. Clearly not every man is an interrupter and not every interrupter is a man. But statistically, this is something that occurs more frequently for women. Women are twice as likely to be interrupted than men are. So there is real research backing to these things. Another term is the bro-propriator. This is the bro who appropriates your ideas. Now, I think many women would attest that this has happened to them at work, but there are also many times when ideas are just incorrectly attributed to men. They're not maliciously doing this. But what the research shows is that even in mixed gender settings, when there is a good idea, we, meaning women and men, will instinctively attribute that idea to a man, and they will get credit. You know, people as high up as the women of the White House are employing some of these tactics. There was an article recently in the Washington Post about how the women in Obama's White House use something called amplification, where they bring each other into their meetings, they reiterate what each other has stated, they call attention back to the person that the idea has come from, and they will interrupt on each other's behalf so that they can get their points out. And so my feeling is, if the women in the most high office in the land, at least in our country, and the highest up women are having to employ some of these tactics, then the rest of us can use them too.
What about women who don't have upwardly mobile jobs? What's in your book and these tactics for them?
I think that all of this stuff applies across the board. You know, when you're whether you're in an hourly wage job or working in a restaurant, you're still likely being mansplained to or interrupted. You're likely going to have to negotiate at one point or another, you know, whether it's for more pay or for flexibility or for vacation time. All of these things occur truly across the board. And I think that some of the tactics that we can employ are really effective. You know, I think we also have to think about larger structural issues, pay equality, raising the minimum wage. But sometimes when you're in the moment and you can't get a word out, you just want something in your back pocket to employ.
You've gotten some flack for some of the words manterrupter and bro-priator and himitator and menstruator. But I tell you, there's something about a flippant one-word label. When I heard mansplaining, that stuck with me, and I hear myself do it, and I try to stop myself. Right? So you're being well, let you describe how you're being.
I'm being tongue-in-cheek, yeah. But I also think that there's a very important linguistic purpose for these words. You know, mansplaining is not a term I came up with. It evolved from the internet over the past few years. It's been hugely popularized, and now it is in the zeitgeist. It's part of the culture and the language. And, you know, one might argue that women have been mansplained to, that's a man explaining something in a pedantic or condescending way, since the dawn of time. But we never had a word to call it out. Suddenly we have a word to describe it. Everyone knows what that word means. And you see people on cable news calling it out in the moment. You see women doing this in their workplaces. And it's a fun and effective way to actually call out the behavior and hopefully correct for it. And I see not just women calling it out, but men too.
Is fighting the patriarchy fun in your experience?
I think that a lot of these issues can be very depressing to talk about all the time. So what my fight club, the real life women of this group, always did was we tried to laugh. You know, a lot of them were comics. We laughed about it and we came up with ways that we could fight patriarchy that we thought were fun. And so I don't think this stuff has to be a burden. You know, we can galvanize, we can work together, and we can make this fun.
Jessica, you interned at KUOW,
I should
point
out,
right after college. Be honest, how sexist was it?
You know, I was mostly working in a restaurant and a bar and was
compared
there
to a bar
very late every night. I think that it was a welcome, refreshing alternative to working in a bar. I didn't find it to be sexist. Not that I noticed, but I don't know that I was so enlightened. You know, Isolde Raftery, your online editor, did an amazing piece earlier this year about lactation rooms. And I know that there was actually some movement made here at the station to create an actual room for breastfeeding,
mm-hmm.
for pumping.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you guys on the scale of things are pretty good.
So we can congratulate ourselves and go to sleep?
You know, let's not give a pat on the back. Your job is to employ these tools and try to make the larger workplace better.
And select our guests with care?
Exactly.
Well, we're glad you're with us, Jessica Bennett, a columnist for the New York Times, author of the new book Feminist Fight Club, and you are holding an event this evening that our online moderator, Isolde Raftery, is moderating the event.
Yes.
7 o'clock, Elliott Bay Book Company, Capitol Hill. And we're glad you joined us. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
KUOW's The Record, back in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Today's young children can recognize hundreds of corporate logos, and yet few of them can identify more than a handful of plants and animals in their own backyard. Well, you're about to meet some preschoolers who are different because they go to school outside. Here's EarthFix reporter Katie Campbell.
A group of preschoolers, some barefoot, are running through the forest. Then a 4-year-old girl stops to pick up a small brown twig and shows it to her teacher, Erin Kenny.
What is it?
Cedar.
It is cedar. You're right. Wait, how come it's not green?
Because it's old. Just the stick of it.
Because it's old and it's just the stick of it? What happens to things when they fall onto the ground?
They're decomposed. Stick and cold.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it will decompose.
This is a typical morning at Cedarsong Nature School, a preschool with no walls or desks, and no worksheets or flashcards. These kids aren't diving into reading, writing, and arithmetic, but that doesn't mean they aren't learning.
There's great learning taking place with young children. When they're just allowed to explore nature, they're learning all kinds of valuable principles about gravity and texture and shapes and colors and all the things that you might expect to see in a preschool curriculum. They're just doing it outdoors and naturally at their own pace.
Can we go for adventure?
You ready for an adventure, Lillian?
This way.
Cedarsong opened in 2006 on Vashon Island, a short ferry ride from Seattle. It was the first forest kindergarten in the United States. Now, a decade later, the outdoor school idea has spread. Similar schools have sprouted across the nation. And that's led some people to wonder if outdoor schools could help solve a different problem. In a park in Seattle, 3-year-old Charlie McGlynn Wright is climbing a boulder with her mom, Annie. At the top, Charlie looks down at her dad, Teddy, with pride at her accomplishment.
Charlie, are you up way high?
Yeah.
Did you climb up all by yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you climb up all by yourself without you?
Probably not without an adult.
I want to.
I know you do.
When Charlie was born, her parents felt pressured to immediately start looking for a preschool. Their search confirmed what other parents had warned them, that many Seattle preschools have years-long wait lists and tuition that rivals the cost of attending college. Teddy McGlynn Wright works for the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative. He recognized that a lack of affordable, high-quality preschools means that children from low-income families and racial minorities can end up falling behind. He wondered if outdoor schools could be a solution.
Because the cost of the building, especially in a place like Seattle where you've got really high property values, and like it's hard to compete when you're this, you know, a school or a nonprofit. But if we cut out the building, that cuts out easily, you know, 30% to 40% of the cost of running a preschool.
So he decided to help start an outdoor preschool called Tiny Trees. For the cost of opening one brick and mortar classroom serving 20 students a day, they're opening 11 classes that serve about 150 students. The pilot program began this school year in the public parks around Seattle. Tuition is set on a sliding scale, and the city is subsidizing part of the cost, based on a student's family income. More than half of the students at Tiny Trees rely on this kind of financial help. And every child receives a full-body rain suit. Charlie was one of the first to be enrolled. From up on the boulder, she starts a careful descent, her parents coaching her down.
Just like that. Good job, Charlie.
Wow, that was a big jump.
For McGlynn Wright, helping Charlie develop confidence to navigate the outdoors is just as important as other preschool lessons.
There are a lot of, you know, black and brown folks, a lot of folks who look like me, who look like her, who don't feel welcome in outdoor spaces, who, whether they're in, you know, city parks, or whether we're talking about the backcountry, And I wanted to make sure that from a really early age, she got the sense of, I belong here and that this place belongs to me.
And he wants all of her classmates, regardless of their race, to develop a lifelong bond with the natural world. In Seattle, I'm Katie Campbell.
We've got online video of these outdoor preschoolers exploring their natural habitat. Just come to our website, kuow.org. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle Mariners lost last night, which means they have to win all five games left in the regular season, and then they would still need certain other teams to lose. That's not going to happen. But wait, that's what people said in 1995. The Mariners were underdogs then, too, but they had this slogan, refuse to lose. That is a warning shot. If we lose, we will not recognize the outcome. That's like Donald Trump saying the election is rigged and his supporters could riot. There was only one other season the Mariners made the playoffs, in 2001, when the catchphrase was, two outs, so what? Again, that's bold. We do not recognize your scoring system. Two outs, so what? Nine innings? Says who? Three strikes? Prove it. We need more of that swagger. I mean, this year's slogan is true to the blue, which Canadian fans just took to mean go Blue Jays. And the older slogans were even weaker. One year the motto was anything can happen. That is technically true. A loss is not guaranteed. Another year, the Mariners invited us to, quote, join the lineup. Wow, you are admitting to your fans that they could very probably get on base more than Richie Sexton. Please apply within. And the limpest slogan of all time was, the Mariners are playing hardball. In other words, we've given you good reason to doubt this, but we have the paperwork to prove that the Mariners are officially enrolled in Major League Baseball and abide by all of its equipment specifications. Come on, Seattle. We got to get back to the swaggering, even dismissive slogans that served us so well. So I went to Hollywood for some ideas. The Mariners, nice league you have here. Shame if something was to happen to it. The Mariners, we got something planned for your wife and kid that they ain't never going to forget, and neither will you, counselor. The Mariners, we will get medieval on you.
Take me to the ball game.
It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. In the news today, for the first time President Obama has been in office, Congress has rejected one of his vetoes. The House voted to override his veto of legislation and let the families of September 11th victims sue Saudi Arabia for the kingdom's alleged backing of the attackers. This lawsuit legislation now becomes law, even though some supporters acknowledged it could trigger lawsuits from people in other countries opposed to U.S. policies and military actions. We'll have the full story later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered, along with Vin Scully retiring and Curious George turning 75 and more on All Things Considered today. Hope you can stay with us.